Stop the Presses. Your host, Mark Anderson, coming to you live on the 10th of February, 2020. And my guest is going to be Oliver Haydorn, a noted author on something I've discussed on this show on occasion before, social credit economics. First disclaimer, it has absolutely nothing to do with the Chinese blacklisting and surveillance system. In fact, it is the polar opposite of that. Do we have Oliver with us yet? Going once, going twice, drum roll, please. It would appear not quite yet. There was some trouble with the Skype connection, I understand, and we are taking backup means. Oliver's with us now?
Yes, I'm here.
Great. Thanks, Oliver. Sorry for the glitch there. The perils of live radio never seem to cease.
That's all right.
But I appreciate you being on this show. I want to say it's your first time on this particular radio show, Stop the Presses. I don't think I'm incorrect in that. I've had Wallace Klink on here before and others talking about monetary reform. Wallace Klink, of course, a noted social credit monetary reform advocate and expert out of Alberta, Canada. And you live in Ontario. You do some traveling to Australia. But give us a quick bio here. I know you're the author of Social Credit Economics. Tell us a little bit about a couple of your books and your website, and then we'll get into some free trade and other issues.
Yes. So I'm a philosopher by training. I did my PhD at the International Academy of Philosophy in the Principality of Liechtenstein under Josef Seifert. And I taught philosophy for many years in various places at various institutions. And more recently, I've been focusing on research in this area of social credit. And I suppose we should make it clear from the outset that when we talk about social credit, we're talking about the monetary reform, economic reform, political reform ideas of the British engineer Major C.H. Douglas, and not the totalitarian surveillance, reward, and punish system, which the Chinese have recently introduced. So we're talking about Douglas social credit or Scottish social credit as opposed to Chinese social credit. And like you were saying, I've written a number of books on the subject. So there's over 500-page tome, which I wrote on Douglas's economic ideas, his monetary reform ideas. That's social credit economics. I did another one on basically comparing social credit with classical distributism, which was the economic theory put forward by Hilaire Belloc and G.K. Chesterton. I did a smaller booklet looking at the points of contact between Douglas social credit and Catholic social doctrine. And the last book that I wrote had to do with social credit philosophy, so all the purely philosophical dimensions of Douglass's thinking, including his social philosophy, which, you know, you can't really understand the monetary reform proposals properly unless you understand how Douglass conceives of society, the purpose of society or the purpose of association, and that the monetary reform proposals are really just a means to an end rather than an end in themselves.
Yeah, that's an interesting part of this. Didn't you also do a book or booklet, A Life of Our Own? That name comes to me.
Yes, yeah, so that was the book, Lives of Our Own is what it was called, and that was the book that looked at social credit and classical distributism, so sort of a compare and contrast.
Oh, that's the one. Okay. Very interesting. Now, in the second half of the show, maybe a little bit leading into that, I want to talk about free trade with respect to the economic ideas that you're an expert at and that you've written about. And, of course, in the news, we've had the U.S.-Mexican-Canada trade agreement that is a reworking of NAFTA, in lack of a better description, by the United States of America. And also, what many thought was impossible, a free trade agreement that is supposed to be balanced and fair for both sides between the United States and China. Now, I want to talk about those in light of social credit insights into trade, mostly in the second half of the show. This first half, we have a break at about 19 after the hour, then there's a short segment, and then there's some ads at the bottom of the hour, and then there's pretty smooth sailing from there to the end. So you've been given so far kind of a preliminary look at this. You know, there's a lot of kind of humor that you see as you look at the economic system. It's almost become an absurdity, the economic system we live in. And I know social credit, having studied it some myself and written about it on occasion, I know that it seeks to fill what's called the gap, that there is an intrinsic, under the current economic paradigm at least, there's an intrinsic shortfall between income and, on the other side, prices and debts. And until we change the monopoly of credit, this economic framework that has both governments and people trapped within it, we're going to have this constant shortfall, this gap. And I know that there's sort of a twin recommendation, a regular dividend paid to the people that is not money taken from one set of taxes or the tax till and given to others. It's not redistributed. It's new credit or new money, simply put, because the economy requires the addition of that money. It's defective in a certain way where absent that dividend, absent that regular dividend to fill that gap, the economy will constantly be in this shortfall of purchasing power. And as Wallace Clink has pointed out, that gap tends to get larger over time if it's not addressed. And so we have all this productive might, but the problem is in consumption, the ability for people to purchase what's been produced, i.e. consumption. And then the other part of it is a kind of reverse sales tax called the compensated discount, which you can explain in a minute. But let's get these nuts and bolts out there because we're sort of living in an economy that's a comedy of errors, you might say. And these things need to be addressed. And I'll mention real briefly before I have you answer this, Oliver. Yesterday I was on Arnie Luke's show at the Australian League of Rights. And listeners live and on the archive can look that up. The Australian League of Rights website, excuse me, and we talk about paradise denied. In other words, the economic recovery that is ours to have that we're being denied under the current paradigm. So that was shot along with Robert Clink and Wallace Clink and the host, Arnie Lukes. But anyway, go ahead and address the dividend and the compensated discount and just explain the essentials of those.
Yeah, so the basic assumption of, you know, the existing economic order, and this is true both of orthodox economists and probably of most heterodox economists as well, is something called Say's Law, that, you know, whatever we produce in terms of costs and prices, it's always being automatically balanced out in the form of income to consumers. And Douglas was an engineer, born in 1879, died in 1952, and both empirically and mathematically, he was able to show that because of the way the financial system operates, because of banking conventions and cost accountancy conventions, Say's Law is not valid. But what actually happens, if you look at a cross-section of, you know, the accounts in any company, they're actually generating costs and prices at a faster rate than they are distributing incomes to consumers in the form of wages, salaries, and dividends. So that means that there's a gap. There is an underlying deficiency of consumer buying power in the form of income in the economy. Now, obviously, that gap has to be filled in one way or another, and when it's not filled, you know, the economy falls into a recession or worse. And because we have a monopoly of credit, like you were talking about before, where we rely on the banking system to provide our money supply in the form of a debt or a debt equivalent, the only way of filling that gap is to get consumers to go to the banks and borrow money from them into existence, because, of course, the banks don't lend pre-existing money. They create the money that they lend out of nothing in the form of digital figures. It's just an accounting operation. And so, you know, consumers right. have to for mortgages, student loans, car loans, all these debt injections are necessary because of this gap between prices and incomes. And, you know, there are other ways of filling it, too. You can insist on constant growth and you know, the creation of more and more jobs so that we're always producing more and more. And that can be both in the private and the public sectors. The idea there being that if we produce stuff now, especially capital production, which we won't have to pay for years down the road, the money that's distributed in that production to workers and owners and management, that can help to fill the gap and allow us to purchase other surplus production, which has already been produced, consumer production, which we wouldn't be able to access otherwise. So Douglass's basic idea was that, you know, instead of trying to fill this gap by borrowing more and more money, you know, whether it's governments borrowing or businesses borrowing or consumers borrowing, instead of us borrowing more money into existence from the private banking system, an organ of the state, call it a national credit office, would simply calculate the additional money which the economy requires to achieve an inherent balance or equilibrium, and would create, in the form of debt-free credits, the extra supplemental income, and would distribute it either directly to consumers in the form of the national dividend, or indirectly on their behalf in the form of a compensated price. So the national dividend is sort of like a universal basic income in that it would be an income that everyone would receive, every citizen, let's say, and it would be given to them independently of their work status, their employment status. And this is actually, you can look at it sort of as the universalization of capitalism. The idea is that we're all co-owners of the economy and entitled to share in its profit. The difference, and this is, we have to stress this, the difference between the national dividend and the universal basic income, I suppose there are two main differences. One is, in social credit, the dividend is not a guaranteed amount, so it depends on what the economy can support. If there's a large gap, then we'll need to create more money to bridge that gap, and the individual dividend payments will be likewise larger. And if the gap is smaller, then the national dividend payments would be less. So it would vary depending on what the economy needs, what it can support. It's not guaranteed. And that's important for a number of reasons, but one is that, you know, a common objection to the universal basic income is that if you gave everyone an income that was not attached in any way to a work requirement, then perhaps too many people would want to rest on their laurels and, you know, they would not provide the work that the economy needs, and then that would cause, you know, slump in production. In the social credit model, if that were to occur, the dividends would also decrease in size, and that would provide sort of a natural feedback indication that more labor was required. So that's one advantage that the social credit national dividend has over the UBI. The second way that it's different is one that you touched on earlier, which is the financing. So most UBI proponents, they are basically working within the existing financial paradigm where, you know, money is debt in one form or another, and if we need more money, then we have to go into debt, or somebody has got to go into debt. And because there is this gap that needs filling, because there are, if you like, excess or surplus production debts that producers have to meet, it is possible, in lieu of all that extra debt, simply to monetize that gap and create credits that don't have to be paid back. So they're debt-free in that sense. But there are credits that are created and injected in virtue of existing debts in the chain of production that still have to be canceled or liquidated by the consumer, because the consumer is the only economic actor who is in a position or who has the role, if you like, to put a final stop to costs and prices, to liquidate costs and prices by purchasing consumer goods and services. That's really the end of the economic process. One of the aphorisms in social credit is that production exists for the sake of consumption. And if we're producing, but it's not for the sake of consumption, then that's basically waste in one form or another. That's an actual dividend.
You make shoes to be worn. You make cars to be driven. You don't just make stuff to stack it up. Absolutely.
Right, right. And on that level, too, if we want the economy to function in an efficient way, well, you know, that is the very definition of efficiency, that we're getting what we need with the least amount of human labor and the least amount of resource consumption. The particular financial system we have in place, because it's got this debt-only paradigm, it actually induces all sorts of extra work and production that's not physically necessary to actually give us the things that we do want from the economy. But we'll talk about that specifically in relation to trade, like you were saying, in the second half.
Yeah, we got about a minute before the break, Oliver. It's very interesting. As you spell this out, it just clarifies, if you will, it kind of tears the mask off this economic paradigm that we're living in, which is tyrannical, to be blunt. And it's very important to unmask it in such a way where we actually see the moving parts, we actually see where the gaps and the flaws are, the defects, and we actually see what needs to be done. So after the break, we can explain in more depth why this is not socialism, just as you've explained already, why it's not the universal basic income or guaranteed income proposals that we've seen. Yes, there are similarities, but you've explained pretty much the differences there. After the break, we'll explain how this is not socialism, important to a lot of listeners live and on the archive here in RBN and readers of my blog, thetruthhound.com and others. But I think it's an idea whose time has come. I think there's a lot of indicators in the world that are leading us to this, that this is not just armchair discussion, that this is really needed and the time is now, I believe. We'll be right back after these ads.
Agree with that.
Plutonic eye, how they drown in incomplete capacity. Strangers thought them all when the fear it calls. How we drown in stylistic audacity. Charge the common ground.
FOMO. Folks, we're living in a world the likes of which we've never perceived any clearer than we do now. The plan for global governance has been in the works for generations and would have likely been achieved by now but for the fact that the globalists left open their Achilles heel. With all their tools, Federal Reserve System, fiat currency, No Child Left Behind, and then Common Core education introduced to our schools to dumb us down, vaccines, pharmaceuticals to lobotomize us, GMO foods, insertion of compromised or bought and paid for politicians, judges, mainstream media propaganda, all pieced together like a puzzle designed to ultimately bring the world under submission. But with all their strategy, they forgot one thing: knowledge. And knowledge is power. With knowledge, their bombardment is nullified. Folks, with that, as brilliant and knowledgeable as you've become, among the wisest audience of any radio audience in the world, and you are, I want you to take a moment to reflect and ask yourself, how much of that knowledge did I obtain from Republic Broadcasting Network? How high has my consciousness been raised since I've been a listener? How fast am I now able to discriminate truth from fake news by being a Republic Broadcasting listener? How clear am I now able to see the world since I've been listening to RBN? Ask yourselves those questions, folks. Then ask yourself, what is that knowledge worth to me? Like my morning coffee, how would I survive without it? A voice of truth in a sea of lies. Do we not all need to make sure it survives? Like public broadcasting, we are now finding we can only survive with listener support. Censorship, advertisers being attacked, truth itself being attacked. It's the only way through this. We at Republic Broadcasting humbly ask you to become a supporter. Look at your budget and make a determination of what Republic Broadcasting is worth to you and what you can afford on a monthly basis. Go to republicbroadcasting.org and pledge 20, 30, 40, 50, if possible, 100 a month or more if it's affordable. Click the donate button and become a regular monthly donor. Assure both us and yourself that Republic Broadcasting Truth will continue to flow like that morning coffee. The network thanks you.
Extend your life with Extendovite.
When your doctor tells you you have bad cholesterol or blockages in the arteries, what do you do? When diet and exercise is not enough, we try medications and hope for the best. For the last two decades, I have been telling people about a natural method to help solve these problems and more. Extendivite can help maintain cardiovascular health and lower blood lipid levels in adults. The seven herbs in Extendivite are known to work together synergistically to get the results we hope for. There are many testimonials on Extendivite's effect on circulatory-related ailments. Get Extendivite today to start your journey back to a healthier life. To order, call 1-877-928-8822 or visit heartdrop.com or see us on amazon.com.
Extend your life with Extendovite.
And welcome back to Stop the Presses here on the 10th of February, 2020. My guest is author Oliver Haydorn. He's from Hamilton, Ontario, Canada, and we're talking about social credit economics, a very, very promising economic reform. And it just shows to go ya, as the saying goes, that the answers to our problems sometimes at first, ladies and gentlemen, might sound a little counterintuitive because we're trapped between the dueling polarities of monopoly capitalism on the right and socialism on the left. And we're told the entire universe, just like Democrats and Republicans in the States, consists of just that, just those options. As Joe Sobran once said, you get 31 flavors of ice cream at Baskin and Robbins, but in economics and politics, you always get two choices. Anyway, Oliver, on that note, let's explain a little bit why social credit is not socialism.
Sure. So, yes, I'll just preface the explanation by saying that, you know, it's understandable that some people would come to the conclusion or, you know, make the assumption that when we're talking about social credit, we must be talking about some form of socialism because, of course, it's got the word social in it. But as a matter of fact, social credit is not only not socialist, it is decidedly anti-socialist. If, you know, if by socialism we're talking about the doctrine of class struggle, the collectivization of the means of production, you know, the command economy or the centrally planned economy or the welfare state with redistributive taxation, or, you know, disordered and excessive forms of economic regulation, Douglas social credit rejects all of those things. So, you know, in a social credit economy, we would still have private property. There would still be personal initiative. We accept the profit motive and, you know, competitive free markets. So we're not talking about, you know, changing the administration of who owns business, who owns businesses or anything like that. What we're talking about really is changing the financial system to make it an honest system. That is to say, to make it a system that accurately reflects the physical facts of production. That's all we're insisting on, just a financial system that you could hold up to the physical economy as a mirror, and it would simply, instead of trying to, you know, limit, control, direct what we do physically, it would just mirror our capacity to produce and mirror our ability to consume. And part of that mirroring would involve recognizing the fact that every individual citizen is rightly recognized as an heir to the most productive factor of all factors of production, which is the cultural heritage, right? So it's knowledge, know-how, discoveries, inventions, etc., that are built up in machinery, principally, that is primarily responsible for our fantastic productive capacity. And, you know, as those inventors and discoverers and so forth, the vast majority of them anyway, are long since dead. We can rightly regard every individual citizen as an heir to their contributions. And since there is this gap, which is largely produced by capital costs, the financial costs of real capital, depreciation, maintenance charges, etc., when we create this money to monetize the gap, this debt-free credit, which is then distributed as a dividend or through the compensated price, it only makes sense that the common consumer should be the chief beneficiary. And that ties in again with the idea that the whole purpose of production is consumption. So in the social credit model, we're basically transforming the whole of society into a gigantic cooperative, in the sense that each individual citizen would be a co-owner. And just as, you know, if you have shares in a company, you draw a dividend, well, we could regard each citizen as having some kind of a share in, let's say, the United States Incorporated or United States Limited. And, you know, depending on how well the economy performs, each citizen should be in a position to draw a dividend. And that would provide them with, you know, economic security to a certain basic minimal degree. And given the size and the strength of the American economy, it should go a long way towards meeting their basic needs.
And provide more leisure time with which people can find their true calling in life and not just be working where work is an end in itself. It's not a means to better ends, where it becomes obligatory and mandatory, and it's just a work state, and it's just march, 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 along goes the proletariat. So, in fact, absent social credit, we are actually much more command and control and socialistic than we would be with it, arguably.
Yes, yes, I think that's a good point, because, you know, the other side to this is, if everyone had a national dividend, let's say, and benefited from compensated prices, well, you know, a lot of the social programs that are in place in every Western democracy, and not only Western democracies, but throughout the world, things like, you know, welfare and employment insurance and things like this, a lot of those things could be reduced or eliminated because people would have the national dividend to fall back on.
And a lot of taxes, too.
Yeah,
we have the break coming up
reduced.
Right here.
You wouldn't have to tax as much if you didn't have to pay for those sorts of social programs. And the bureaucracies that we rely on to implement them and regulate them and so on and so forth, those things could either be...
You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
Hey, honey, I'm home. I grabbed the newspaper on the way home. Look at all the news today.
The newspaper? Don't you know that all you're going to get in the newspaper is propaganda, twisted news, and false information?
Honey, this is a national newspaper. It has to be true.
Ha! For some reason, a majority of the population believe anything the mainstream media tells them. The newspaper does not give out the important attention on what's happening to this country and news that affects our daily lives. Say, does that newspaper mention anything about the North American Union?
No, not that I can see.
I didn't think so. You need to go to www.newswithviews.com, where truth is more important than political correctness. That's www.newswithviews.com. Hey, don't throw that away. We can use that in the birdcage.
Okay, move over. Let me start reading newswithviews.com.
The truth? Read all about it at newswithviews.com. Newswithviews.com, where reality shatters illusion.
Here at Republic Broadcasting Network, we have been building our online store. Well, we have been focusing on bringing you the best talk show host in the country. Here at Republic Broadcasting Network, we also want our listeners to have products they can use every day and in times of emergency. We have added new products each week to our store. Your support of this network, plus products at the best prices, is a win-win situation. Check out our new store. Go to our website, republicbroadcasting.org, and click on the online store located at the top of our website. Together, we can continue to grow RBN and help our listeners prepare for the future. Go to republicbroadcasting.org and click on our online store. Or call us.
800-724-2719, extension 3. 800-724-2719, extension 3.
Homeowners, are you in foreclosure, expecting to be served with a foreclosure lawsuit, or suspect your lender has coerced you into an illegal mortgage transaction? A huge number of mortgages made in the last 10 years have legal issues and are possibly defective. State laws and the U.S. Supreme Court have upheld that defective mortgage documents are grounds for foreclosure defense and for counterclaims in favor of the homeowner. If your mortgage has been sold or assigned since closing the loan, it may be defective and you may be paying the wrong party, and the lender may not have standing or the right to foreclose or collect payments under the law. If you would like to know if your mortgage is legal or not, or know if you are paying the right party, we can help. Our initial consultations are free of charge. We are not attorneys. We are legal researchers and work closely with experienced lawyers who know how to help you find the evidence to help you keep your home. Call toll-free 1-855-2-KEEP-IT. That's 1-855-2-KEEP-IT today.
Welcome back to Stop the Presses. Your host, Mark Anderson, coming to you live as of the 10th of February, 2020. And we're trying to see with 2020 vision today into the defects in the economy, which of course affects the social and economic and political systems, and how to fix those defects. My guest is Oliver Haydorn. A couple quick housekeeping notes. A book that I have promoted on this show before, Universal Bankruptcy and Economic Bondage, where I wrote the foreword and edited the book by Mickey Paletta of Pennsylvania. We are getting new copies of that book that are being shipped Wednesday, and these are going to be hardcover. We sold out of the trade paperbacks. They went quite quickly, and I think we're going to be letting them go for no more than $19.95, figure $20, and they'll be shipped Wednesday, so more of those will be available. Universal Bankruptcy and Economic Bondage. You can email me, truthhound2@yahoo.com, truthhound, the number 2, at yahoo.com, and you can inquire about when those will be available, which will be quite imminently. They'll be available quite soon, excuse me. Also, Alice and the Money Tree by John Briggs, a children's book of rhyme and verse, but it's good for adults too. That teaches about the basic money scam, the basic trickery that the banksters use. That's still available, a smaller hardcover for $10. Alice and the Money Tree. Again, contact me at that email address, or you can contact the station about either or both books. And we'll give information soon about Oliver Haydorn's books, which we've mentioned a little bit, but we'll give more contact and ordering information on that as well momentarily. Oliver, before we get into free trade in this second half of the show, with respect to the foundation of social credit that we discussed in the first half, I wanted to mention how the shortage of money in the economy, I think a lot of people sense it sort of instinctively. They know there's something drastically wrong, and it manifests itself in weird ways and in unpleasant ways and in humorous ways. Of course, it seems to me that on the more unpleasant side of the ledger, there's a lurching toward crime. In other words, where the economy is short of one of its most vital resources, that is purchasing power, people will also fill that gap, not wanting to work away at a drudgery, no end, or dead-end job, you know, a slave wage or wage-slave job. They don't want to do that, and it seems to generate the incentives for criminal behavior to embezzle, to steal, to get into all forms of duplicity, invent defective or dangerous products and market them, get them past the regulators. Your brief comments on that?
Well, I think that's right. Douglas has some very insightful passages in his 1924 book entitled Social Credit, where he talks about how the financial system, the existing one that we've got, is probably the greatest incentive, or provides the greatest incentives to crime in all its forms, as well as, you know, white collar crime is too, because we're all laboring under this artificial lack of buying power. We're not given by the system enough money in the form of income to buy back in full whatever we produce. So it causes a lot of conflict and strife, and sometimes people, because of that pressure, they will do things that are illegal or immoral to try to make ends meet.
Yeah, it seems to me that the tyranny that we see through the globalist organizations, through the central banks, the deep state, of course, is much more than just the government. It's much more than just the CIA. It's tax-exempt foundations with names like Rockefeller and Carnegie and Morgan. It's think tanks like the Council on Foreign Relations. The deep state has a lot of branches and tributaries. And it seems to me that this financial system is ready-made to give incentive to create these kind of organizations, because when you have a gap, those with the muscle, those with the long-term experience in finance and Wall Street, those with the acumen and the cleverness, you know, to navigate the rough waters of the current economic paradigm, they have an automatic advantage, and they can build these pyramidal political and economic systems primarily to protect themselves from others in the system, while they game the system with unique advantages and others are knocked down lower and lower and lower down the pyramid. And so it seems to me that this system encourages and practically requires tyranny for it to operate. Otherwise, it would fall by its own dead weight.
Yes, I think that's correct as well. You can sort of look at it as an institutionalized form of the problem reaction solution dynamic, because if you've got this gap that's always being generated, you know, somehow we've got to fill it. And Douglas is of the opinion that the greatest factor behind the growth of government in the last, let's say, the 12th and 20th century, but, you know, since he died, it's only intensified, has been the fact that we have this problem, and we have to appeal to the authorities, please do something, you know, borrow more money, spend money, do something, make work projects, do whatever it needs to be done so that we can keep the thing afloat.
Yeah, fight a war even. Let's do that. I mean, that's the greatest. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's the part I really wanted to get out there. And so let's switch to free trade. And I know you've produced a couple of videos about this. We'll give contact and location information for your books and videos toward the end. We've got about 20 minutes or so. But in the realm of trade, this international, because it's not just the States, it's not just Canada where you live, it's pretty much global, worldwide. There's this lack of purchasing power to one degree or another. How does that affect what we call free trade?
Yeah, so on Douglas's analysis, because each country that's running this financial system has a lack of consumer buying power in its economy, as I was saying before, we've got to find some way to fill it. So one of the ways you can fill it is by exporting more than you import. So this transforms international trade into a fight. You know, each country basically is trying to get a favorable balance of trade, because if you export more than you import, the difference basically, you know, you take back to your country in the form of money tokens. So while exporting more than you import is a loss in physical terms, because, you know, you're giving away more goods than you're getting in return, nevertheless, from a financial standpoint, given the skewed way that our existing financial system registers favorable trade balances, it's actually a financial plus, because, you know, we've got more incomes, more profits, and we can use those then to spend it on domestic goods and services for which perhaps, you know, there's not enough income being distributed domestically. The problem, though, of course, is that it's a zero-sum game. So for every country that is a winner in this struggle to export more than you import, there's going to be a loser. And this generates a lot of tension between countries. It's really quite foolish because, you know, if the financial system reflected reality, if it was simply mirroring reality and just facilitating what we wanted to do physically with our resources, the only purpose in international trade would be a mutually beneficial exchange of goods for goods. Right? So if there are things that we produce here in Canada that you don't produce at all in the United States, don't produce as enough of or as well as we can here, then it makes sense for us to export that to you in exchange for, let's say, oranges, which we can't grow here. Right? That sort of international trade makes sense. That's mutually beneficial, goods for goods. But under the current financial rules, regulations, the way the system operates, it incentivizes each country trying to export as much as possible and to you know, restrict their imports, if at all possible, and to enjoy the financial plus that gives them. As you know, it's basically, you could regard it as a debt-free input from outside the country to top up their own domestic purchasing power.
Yeah, very interesting. It's clear that the countries, because they don't have enough internal purchasing power, they go searching for purses and wallets and purchasing instruments in those purses and wallets in other nations, because their own home nation intrinsically doesn't have enough of that. So it's kind of an indirect admission that internal domestic economies are lacking, and we fill the gap through this internationalization. It's interesting, too, what you said. You know, a country would want to get coffee from Central America, maybe because much of the states you can't grow coffee, at least you can't grow it efficiently, except maybe if you tried it in South Texas where I'm at or something. And then in return, we would send Central America, where they grow the coffee, we'd send them something that they would have trouble producing in any quantity or quality, if at all. And, you know, I read part of the trade agreement with U.S., Mexico, and Canada, the reborn or NAFTA 2.0, and it talked in some sections, in the agriculture section on the United States Trade Representative website, it talked about how we're going to get all kinds of Canadian dairy, milk, cream, you name it. Even eggs were mentioned. I'm thinking, okay, what's the shelf life here? How's this working? These are perishable items, cheese and whatnot. I'm thinking, so the United States can't, let me take a stab, raise dairy products and consume its own, and Canada couldn't do that itself. Wouldn't we want to trade something where it's more of the mutual benefit we're talking about? There's an absurdity there. You're dealing with perishable items, especially dairy, a dairy highly perishable. You know, if it's even slightly past the date, people are very hesitant to eat it. And so, you know, you're looking at that. I once had a debate with Peter Sutherland of Bilderberg fame, Trilateral and whatnot. And he told me how it was a good thing. He used to be head of the WTO for a while. It was a good thing, or at least a tolerable thing, that Japan would raise all kinds of rice and, you know, go through all that labor and fuss and must to do it, only to ship most of it away and then receive rice from somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
And so you have this trade absurdity as opposed to the beneficial trade. Your thoughts?
Well, that's right. My favorite example for that, you know, within a Canadian context, has to do with apples. So, of course, we grow apples here. I think the quality of our apples are quite good. And we export them to various places, but one of the places we export them to is New Zealand. And New Zealand, also a good place for growing apples, exports their apples to us here. And,
wow.
You know, no one seems to... I would wish that some of the environmentalists or, you know, the greenies would sort of take a closer look at all this trade that's going on that's not mutually beneficial. It's just, you know, we're competing for purchasing power in the New Zealand market and they're competing for purchasing power in the Canadian market. And all because,
not because
we need apples, but because we both need money, of which there is a lack. There are enough apples. There just isn't enough money in the form of income.
And that was my point. That's the central salient point of this whole discussion on trade, is that it's all predicated on money. Money is controlling the economy rather than people controlling money. In other words, we all have to answer to the lack of money, rather than having money answer to the needs of the economy.
That's right. And the only way to get money to answer to the needs of the economy is to make it an accurate indicator of what's actually going on. So money has to stop being a commodity, and it has to start being just a neutral tool that gives us accurate information concerning production and consumption. The way the financial system is right now, you know, incentivizing things like favorable trade balances, that, as I was saying before, that in physical terms, in real terms, that's a loss. But the financial system says that it's a plus, and that the more you export over, you know, the imports you take in, the better off you should be. Well, take that to its logical conclusion. Imagine, you know, a country that had the most favorable balance of trade possible, where they were exporting all of their production and accepting no imports in return. Right? That would be, that's the logical endpoint of that type of thinking. Well, what's the problem with that? Well, the problem, of course, is that that country, while they would have lots and lots of money, they would have no real goods and services. And without goods and services, the population would starve, you know, would be without health care, would be without shelter, so on and so forth. So in many ways, it's just one example. There are so many other examples one could point to. But because the financial system is not an honest system, it's not an accurate system, it limits and distorts what's going on. But because we have to play according to its rules, we actually end up adopting policies that are self-defeating, and that it makes us do things that we don't, in a physical terms, we don't have to do or we shouldn't have to do, and all because there's simply not enough income to offset what we do produce.
Yeah, it's amazing, and there's so many rippling effects, even in popular culture. You know, just this morning, I saw an ad for a CBS show called Good Girls, and these girls are going to make money, and they're going to make Federal Reserve notes using nail polish remover, of all things. It's just some sort of absurd, TV show, a parody of some kind. But even that speaks to this sort of inherent, intrinsic, instinctive feeling we all have that something is just not right. So they're gonna make all these Federal Reserve notes, and the implication is they're all gonna be perfect, and these notes will pass for real money, and that's how they're gonna fill their gap. And then, you know, even if you watch game shows, and this is just a passing comment, you watch these game shows like The Price is Right, and a new one with DeGeneres, as the host, and you know, people are going through trap doors, they're putting on monkey suits, I mean, anything to get a buck. Because the one thing about money that everyone knows is they don't have enough of it. And they just go through absolute humiliation to try and win 5, 10, 15, 20 grand. You know, so it's got people, kind of going to personal lengths and themselves to, you know, outrageous behavior, not just criminal behavior, but comical behavior, just to try and get the almighty dollar that there's not enough of. You know, just a quick social observation there.
Yes, well, in those are all good examples. In many ways, we have a system where money becomes an idol, and we have to placate it. And that's, you know, it's put in that position because of this reality of artificial scarcity. So money becomes an idol, it becomes master of our activities, when in fact, if it were simply an indicator, we would be the master of our activities, and money would just be a servant to, you know, catalyze production and to distribute goods and, you know, consumer goods and services.
Yeah, that's well put, that if we don't master money, it'll master us. It becomes a form of idolatry. That should interest Christians as well as everyone else. It is certainly idolatry. And, you know, there are biblical and Christian implications, especially Catholic ones, and you've written a book about that with regards to these matters. That's the sinew for another show. We do have a caller. We got about 8 minutes. I think Lark is still with us. He's a caller from Texas. We're going to have to keep it sort of brief, Lark, because the end of the show creeps up quite quickly, if you're still there.
Yeah, I am. How are you?
Great. Hey, thanks for calling.
Okay, I'll try to be brief. You know, I have been studying this matter of social credit for a number of years, and I think there's quite a number of good ideas. But I think today we cannot ignore the reality on the ground of what's happening, because we, as we know, it is control of money which brings about the control of the law. In other words, the power of the purse, that which wields the power of the purse wields the power of the sword. And
yes.
That sword is rather much like a sword of Damocles hanging over the hearts of every man, woman, and child, all biological life on this planet today, as I see it. And, you know, we have to recognize the reality of what the money masters have in mind for us and what is being orchestrated, has been orchestrated throughout our lifetimes, our parents' and our grandparents' lifetimes. You know, one example on YouTube is a video. It's entitled "Everything is Connected." Club of Rome, UN climate change, population control, Agenda 21, 2030. What I'm driving at is that these people have it in their mind to eliminate nation states, and they're well on their way to achieving that. They also want to place in its stead the nation state, what they term a market security state. And this will by extension, will give rise to the city state. And now we're talking about a form of governance, a scientific form of governance involving management by technocrats and experts and scientists and the like. And it has a lot to do with this this technology today, especially these GRIN technologies, genetics, robotics, information, and nanotech. And, I mean, these people do not want the individual to be in charge of their own economic destiny at all. And that's why I have a big problem with anybody controlling the money supply at all. I always have felt that the individual should own the wealth, however it's measured, and that means that the so-called government or any kind of authoritarian overlord, they have to answer to the individual. And I don't like this idea of democracy anyway. I don't believe in mobocracy. I don't want to have to compete for my voice to be heard, you know, in a sea of low-knowledge voters, for instance. So anyway, your thoughts about any of these things I bring up?
Go ahead, Oliver.
Yeah, so one of Douglass's basic principles, is, you know, as far as sort of social philosophy is concerned, is that whether we talk about the monetary system, you know, the economic system or the political system, The critical thing is that we have to discover or implement forms, let's say, mechanisms that will allow the common citizens to sanction the relevant authorities, whether they be bankers or politicians or whoever, so that whenever, because those authorities, they should be servants. They shouldn't be masters who are trying to impose a policy against the will of the common people. They're there to serve the common people. And so I don't think we can get rid of government completely, but we have to find effective means of controlling government, of sanctioning government, so that, you know, when government tries to do something you don't like, you can neutralize it, you can opt out. And certainly, you know, if Douglass used to say that, you know, if people had, for example, a national dividend, that this would be a sort of voting mechanism where people would have a certain, at least minimum, number of monetary votes, economic votes that they could spend however they saw fit, and it wouldn't be something that could be taken away from them. So right now, if you say something, perhaps, that somebody thinks you shouldn't say and you lose your job, you're penalized economically for it, although in theory you've got free speech. But if you have a national dividend to fall back on, that gives you a basis, a secure basis, from which you can make your viewpoints known, knowing that if the system is set up properly, and this is recognized as an unconditional, irrevocable, inalienable right that no one can take from you, that you would be in a position to speak your mind without fear.
Yeah, let me just interject this. I don't believe that there's any man alive. Yeah, I'll be brief. I don't believe there's any man alive that has ever lived or ever will live that's qualified to tell me what to think and what to do. That's just the way I see it. You know, I don't consider the Pope, the Queen of England, or the Rothschild bankers to be my authority figures, the people I look up to. And I do not like the idea of having to actually beg someone to do right by me. Mm-hmm. And that's what I have. That's the problem I have with the social credit system, because you still, whether you call it the Federal Reserve or the so-called government or Uncle Sammy or just whoever, you know, we somehow accede to the authority of people that think that we're better qualified to think for us. And therein lies the problem. So anyway, something to think about.
I appreciate it, Mark. We got to get some housekeeping items in. But yeah, that's a very good question. It's sort of the one that many people will arrive at as they study these things. Thanks again for calling. Oliver, give your contact information on how people can check out your books.
Yes, yeah, so my website is socred.org, socred.org, and that is the website of the Clifford Hugh Douglas Institute for the Study and Promotion of Social Credit, which is a not-for-profit here in Canada. And I've got a link there to all my publications, which are available through the Amazon network.
Great. And yeah, that question, the quick answer I would give to
homeowners, if your lender has gone out of business or
something, a way that would moralize the economy and bring a greater moral vision to it, where abuses would at least become less likely and we could go down a different ethical trajectory. That would be my short answer.
Find all your favorite conservative talkers.
Everyone, thanks for listening. We'll see you next time on Stop the Presses.
Keep up with the fast-paced political world. Download Talk Right today from Google Play or the App Store.
Claims in favor of the homeowner. We are having successes in stopping the process of foreclosure, the enforcement of the foreclosure judgments, the sale of property, and evictions after the sale. We are not attorneys, and we don't give legal advice. We are a professional team of legal researchers, providing forensic mortgage audits and expert witnesses. We have the knowledge to produce the evidence and enforce laws regarding your legal issues. We've been in business for 12 years without a complaint. Consultations are free, and we provide a free title search to confirm if your mortgage has legal defects. Please call 855-253-3748. 855-2, keep it today.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.